do try to collect some of the discarded Stinger connectors for that model number of cable. And model numbers are a little bit crazy. You and I would call it half inch and three quarter inch. They call it 500 and 750. You ask them for 750 cable, they know exactly what you want. You ask them for three quarter inch hardline, and they'll say, what are you talking about? I'm amazed that people have blinders on their particular occupation. So the cable has the exact same weight as RG8 cable, even though it is more than twice the diameter and one-tenth the loss. So it's a beautiful cable. The one slight disadvantage I can think of connecting it to the center of a dipole is that most dipole installations sway in the breeze. And for a piece of flexible RG8 to sway in the breeze with it, with a Balun device connected, that's not much of a problem. In the case of hardline, you sway it in the breeze continuously, and there's a slim chance you're going to get crystallization of aluminum. The outer jacket may give you a fatigue failure. I doubt it, but it's something to be concerned about, how you mechanically support it. And the need for the Balun at the antenna, at the dipole, if you're a purist, it'll work without the Balun. But if you really want it to work a little bit better, you will put a Balun device. And whether you put the Balun on the far end of a piece of hardline or the far end of a piece of RG8, really there's no difference there. So if you're a serious VHF operator, you definitely want hardline cable. You want to use as little flexible cable as possible because of insertion loss. As an HF operator, the price is right, go do it, but you don't have to use cable of quite that much quality. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY, Ron, just for nothing. You can't complain. No, the question really is, how do you join it? You know, mechanically, I guess that's what he most likely is intimating, that he would like to know, how do you join it? He's got a pole, a wooden pole, that's, I guess, a telephone pole, and he wants to run the hard line, I see, up the pole, the 70-ohm hard line, up the pole, and he wanted to know how would you join the dipole, how do you do it mechanically up there? Do you just separate off something? I guess you got to do some kind of sealing at the end and all, but how do you do it? Is there any secret to mechanical connection at that point for a 40-meter dipole? I guess this is basically what the question was, Dick, over.
And so we go with a comment.
Yeah, I may have missed the question. Rich recognized. If I have a connector on the end of my RGA cable and I want to connect it to my dipole, I would screw the UHF connector into the back end of a Balun, and the Balun itself would be where I solder on the wires of the dipole itself, and it supplies mechanical support, a convenient place to connect the wires of the dipole, and so on. A hell of a lot of guys will take the end of a piece of RGA cable and strip it away so that you have braid coming out to the right and semiconductor going out to the left, and you simply solder them onto the dipole with an egg insulator in the center. A slightly more sophisticated approach is to have a piece of plexiglass in the center with the appropriate holes drilled in it. And so the dipole is wrapped through those holes of the plexiglass, and then by various binding techniques, the cable is mechanically held to the block of plexiglass at the center of the dipole. That's if you don't buy one of these balancing devices. The only way I know of to do a good job of weatherproofing the end of the hard line is to put a Stinger connector on. The Stinger connector itself is not perfect, but it does an extremely good job of weatherproofing the end of the connector, as well as supplying an extremely strong mechanical connection to the end of the hard line. In other words, any reasonable length of hard line could be mechanically suspended by that connector, the Stinger connector, as long as the Stinger connector is properly mated with the cable, properly tightened down. It's got a collet mechanism in there that very nicely sandwiches and grabs onto the outer conductor of the hard line with some very aggressive teeth that dig into the hard line. And so properly installed, you'll never get that connector, you know, ripped off the end of the hard line without really ripping the hard line apart. So mechanically, There's a zillion ways you can do it, but start off with the finger connector. Yes, you could fill up the end of the cable with a great big blob of elastic adhesive as a way of weatherproofing it. I think the finger connector installation is mechanically a better way. Let's see what Rich has to suggest. M2EO, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Tigger, I was going to suggest when you brought up using either a center hang-up hook or a ballast with a connector and the appropriate adapter. So you answered the question, Dick. When you get a chance, I have an inquiry.
Okay, I'm going to pass it back to Mel for any further comments on this. He's going to give us at least one more of his emails, and then we'll come back to you. You got it, Mel.
Hey, very good, Dick. Yeah, I guess basically that's what he wants to do is use the 70 ohm cable directly to the dipole and use the hard line directly, use it as feed directly to the dipole, and then wants to know the method of doing that. He wants to know if the 70 ohm cable can be used directly to the dipole. This is the way it's worded. Can I use the 70 ohm hard line cable directly to the dipole without anything else in between? And how would I guess that's trying to get this out. So how would I connect it at that point? So in other words, basically it breaks down to the question, can you go directly to the dipole with the 70 ohm hard line without any kind of balloting device? So I guess this is what it breaks down to, Dick, over.
Yeah, a dipole without a balun fed from any kind of coax cable works like a charm. It's a tiny bit less than ideal. You do launch some current on the outside of the cable if you're not using a balancing device. You could, if you wanted to, take the end of the hard line connector, strip back some of the outer shield, bend over the center conductor to the left, and the center conductor does have copper plating on the outside of the center conductor. You could solder that directly to one side of the dipole. That would work. Making the other half of the dipole make good electrical contact and good mechanical contact to the aluminum outer sheet of the hard line, that request is considerably more difficult because now you've got a dissimilar metal problem. The copper of your dipole, and most people will use copper, and the aluminum of the hard line should not come into direct contact. They are dissimilar metals out in the weather. And if you're within 200 miles of a major body of water, like the Atlantic Ocean, you are getting some salt spray. And salt mixed in with copper that's in direct contact with aluminum is making a small battery that's eventually going to develop some pretty serious corrosion. The Stinger connector has the right kind of interfacing metals so that there is not a dissimilar metal problem. So the Stinger connector supplies three things for you: mechanical support, weatherproofing, and it solves the dissimilar metal problem. So I strongly recommend using the Stinger connector. But if you're really crafty and you put a big blob of elastic adhesive on the end of the cable so that water doesn't crawl down the cable, I guess there are some ways that you could use the so-called pigtailing technique of connecting your copper wire of the one half of the dipole to the shield of the hard line. Particularly if you use the right kind of a salve that is made for repairing indoor wiring of houses that has aluminum wiring. They make a special compound, no locks or something like that they call it, and then drilling a small hole in the outer conductor, putting a screw through it, putting a solder lug underneath that, soldering your copper wire to it, putting a liberal coating of this material is made to solve the problem of dissimilar metals, and then wrapping the whole thing with a bunch of elastic adhesive and or electrical tape. There are various ways you could weatherproof it. I think it would end up looking a little bit homely, but I think it would work. If you're crafty enough, you could make that work. I don't recommend it. It's a tough way to go. I forget. Maybe Rich had a comment on this one. Did you, Rich? Go ahead.
No, Dick, it's just that, like I say, I would use at least some type of a hang-up hook with a connector.
Yeah, the right way to do it is the stinger connector first, and then by various plumbing fittings, you can adapt that to a PL-259, and the PL-259 will screw into the back end of a ballining structure, which is made for dipoles, and it supplies all the mechanical support and weatherproofing and convenience and ballining function and whatever. That's the elegant approach. And various subsets of that by using a block of plexiglass can be made to work, or plexiglass and a glass or porcelain insulator, egg insulator in the center for the dipole wire itself. So dipoles are nowhere near as critical as you think. If your ohm meter can confirm that the center conductor of your transmission line, your coax cable, is connecting to one side of the dipole, and if your ohm meter can confirm that the shield of the transmission line is connecting to the other side of the dipole, and if the ohm meter placed from center conductor to shield does not show a short circuit, if you can pass those three ohm meter tests, then at least for that period of time that you have that level of contact, that dipole must work. It sounds a little bit crazy, where an ohm meter is testing your dipole at DC frequency, 0 hertz, and you're going to be feeding at an HF frequency at 3.5 or 7 megacycles, you would think there'd be a huge difference. There is almost no difference. You pass the ohm meter test, the dipole's got to work. After that, it's only a matter of making it the right length so it's resonant, if you're not using an antenna tuner, and putting it at the right altitude, and properly supporting it with egg insulators at the end, and pieces of rope or whatever going over to your tree or whatever the other mechanical support is. So people who have never built a dipole think that you've got to follow a whole lot of very strict rules for angles and horizontalness and sag in the center and the right diameter of wire and the right length, the nearest millimeter, and so on. If you've never built one, it's easy to fall into the trap to think that all of those are critical characteristics and dimensions, and that if you don't follow them, it won't work. Well, if you can pass that ohm meter test, it is very difficult to make a dipole that will not work. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I think we've covered that as much as possible. And, yes, like I should say, it seems that the hard line is an excellent cable used properly. And I'm sure that the way that Dick just outlined methods, I'm sure one of them will definitely work. But like Dick said, the dipole is straightforward, and I'm sure it'll be able to get this antenna working fairly well. All right, let's see if I have anything else here. I think I picked out the major ones. Dick, you want to go on, and then I'll see if I'll read through some others. Really behind, Dick, with this email, because they're overwhelming. You know, to pick through each one and try to answer as accurate as possible, you know, be conscious to, you know, give the right answer and take the time and the patience. It's to be trying, Dick. I can't, you know, sit down and do this exclusively. K2RIW, this is K2KEY.
Why? You're preaching to the choir, Mel. I know where you are. I've been there. When I first started writing articles for QST Magazine, way back in the 70s, there were quite a few guys who were mailing me letters. Email didn't exist in the dark ages back then, so everything was done with snail mail. There was one particular human being in Snug Harbor, Maryland, who wrote me 14 consecutive letters in a one-month period, where each letter consisted of two pages, and each of the two pages had 6 or 7 questions on them. I'm talking about what's on each individual letter, and there were 14 of those letters. He rapidly concluded he was getting a whole lot of free consulting service, and boy, did he have questions. Reasonable questions. But since I was getting 300 and some odd letters per year as a result of that article, you can see it very rapidly get out of hand. And so, since then I've told people, please don't write to me. Please don't email me. I'll talk to you on the air. I'll talk to you on the telephone. But I'm a slow typer. I'm a slow writer. And I've got a certain amount of time that I have to spend with my family and do other things. That man in Maryland, I can't live his life for him. And you've heard the other story about the man who was in Mexico and sent me a check drawn on a Mexican bank where he wanted to start the project of me helping him design a dish, a feed horn, a down converter, a low noise amplifier. This is back in the days before TVROs, television receive-only terminals, were popular. He wanted to build one homebrew for S-band satellite reception because his wife told him that if he can supply her American television, this American wife would stay in Mexico City with him. And if he couldn't, she was going to leave him. And so he wanted me to help him build this system. And considering the resources he had, it would have taken a good fraction of a year with me holding his hand. And so it wasn't a reasonable request. It's a reasonable request in what he wanted, but the amount of time, man hours required to do it was not reasonable. That's one of about 10 that I used as an example of what can happen in a situation like this. Rich, I know you had another query, so let's see what's going on in the Tashina household. And where's Barry? I talked to Barry on the air. I guess it was Wednesday or Thursday. He promised me he's going to come back and we're going to discuss air, compressed air in automobiles. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2PNJ.
Stand by a second, Rich, before you start off. Go ahead, Bob.
The dummy loads used to, heat kit used to sell with a gallon can of mineral oil. I was wondering if I could put one of those together, what kind of resistor would I use in that submerged in the oil?
I know a quick way you can solve that problem, Bob. There is a 40% chance that I own one of those and I'm not using it. You wouldn't have to select the can. You wouldn't have to select the resistor. You just have to supply the oil. As I said, I'm not positive I'll be able to find it, but I know where it was a year ago, and it might still be there in my pile of paraphernalia. But to answer your question directly, Heathkit did find some brand name of resistor that was probably counterwound in such a way that whatever inductance it built up on the clockwise winding, it canceled most of it on the counterclockwise winding. So there is a fancy way of winding a wire-wound resistor around a tubular object so that it gives you very little series resistance, a series reactance. And that's something you've got to worry about. You just take ordinary nichrome wire, round it, wind it in a toroid, in a solenoid manner, and you will end up with a substantial amount of inductance that maybe won't hurt you very much on 160 meters, but by the time you get up to 10 meters, I'm a little worried that your dummy load would be more inductive than resistive, and therefore not too good a dummy load. Back to you, Bob.
There was an update on it, the change that Dick.
Say that again?
Okay, the Cantenna, it was called the Cantenna. A number of people had failures of that resistor, and there's a way that you can go ahead and rebuild the Cantenna, which I have done by another best method that is easy to do over.
Why don't you give us a few words on that, Bill?
Okay. What you do, and there's a number of ideas, but basically here's what you do. For instance, what you do is make up a, you get by carbon resistance. Like, say, let's say you pick, let's say, 1,000 ohm carbon resistance. Now, you want to know how many of these carbon resistance. So you take, say, if, say, it's 1,000 ohm carbon resistance, 2 watts, and you divide it by 50 ohms, or 50, you'll know you need 20 of them in parallel submerged into the fluid. So what they did, you take two pieces of copper plate and you suspend the resistance between them in parallel, and you go ahead and then you submerge it back into, now what deteriorated on it was that transformer oil, which is against the law to use because it had a lot of PVCs in it. What they recommend is you replace it with, get rid of that properly. You take it to get rid of that oil if it's still filled, or it has the PVC original oil in it. You take it over to Edison Company and they'll dispose of it properly. And you refill it with transmission fluid, with the ATF. And if you want to, depends on how much power you want to put into it. Now, if you want, you can make up with the number of resistors two stack, so that's 25 ohms each, and put them together that way. In other words, a number of ways, depending on the resistance. Now, I found it was easy to get a 1,000-ohm resistor, Allen Bradley, 1,000-ohm, 2-watt resistors. I got 20 of them and made it up that way, submerged it in the ATF, and it worked fine, Dick, over.
Dick, MFJ, who owns the Meritron, sells those non-inductive resistors, same thing used for the Cantana.
Roughly how many dollars do they sell that for, Rich?
I don't have a price, but I bought a Meritron dry dummy load, which uses 8 of them. The 50 ohm resistors, yeah, I think there's 4 or 8, there's 4 of them in there. And it's good for a maximum of 3 kilowatts for 1 minute, but they do sell individual components now.
Interesting. An ATF transmission fluid. I expected you to say use mineral oil that you buy from a drugstore. But ATF transmission fluid is made for high temperature service. How about that? And those 20 resistors of 1,000 ohms each, you're stacking them between pieces of copper clad in what's called cord wood construction. In other words, it's the equivalent of laying a bunch of logs on top of each other, is the way the resistors are stacked, and you've got holes drilled in the appropriate positions on the copper clad, and you solder one sheet of copper clad on the left side of all of those left-hand end of the resistor lead, and the same thing on the right-hand side. So you end up with this disc, this circular, a pair of circular discs with all the resistors in between the two. And you can mount a SO239 connector on one of those, on the center of one of those copper clad sheets, with a big thick rod coming through the center conductor connecting to the other sheet. If you end up with a very low inductance launching structure inside of that Cantana made with an SO239, if you chose that method of construction. Anybody got any further comments on this? This is a fun way to make dummy loads. And has anyone ever made a measurement of one of these, whether it be the Heathkit Cantana, the MFJ, or any of these approaches? What kind of standing wave ratio as a dummy load do you get at 30 megacycles, 10 meters? Anybody any further comments? This is a jump ball, KQRIW.
About 1.5 to 1 on 10 meters. Usable at 2 meters with about a 2 to 1.
That ain't bad. Anybody got any other further comments on that one?
Well, what I was just telling you about, this is to rebuild the original heat antenna. The connector is on the can already. And what you use is 2 strips of copper thick, about an inch and a half wide by about, I don't know, extend down close to the bottom of the can, about maybe 4 inches, 5 inches, or whatever it is. I would have to really find the article. They had it in one of the magazines. In fact, you'll find, if you want to see the whole thing with the pictures, how they did the whole thing, if you go to Ham Radio, if you remember the ARRL, you can go to, articles, and it was in Ham Radio back maybe about 15, 20 years ago. You could bring up that article, and they'll show you exactly how to cut the copper strips, where to drill the holes, and solder, how to solder it up and mount it up in there in the can, and the whole business, the whole deal. It was, like I say, specifically for modifying the Cantana wet load type of dummy load, Dick, over.
KB1 on that point. Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, I have the HRO catalog here. I found the MFJ250. It's the 1K dummy load here. It's $69.95. I think that's the one Rich was talking about.
Is that just the resistor or the whole setup?
Looks like a paint can here. It's got, says 50 load, 50 dummy load, 50 ohm oil filled dummy load. Is that the one he's talking about?
I think that's the one they're talking about. There's a lot of fun ways of making a dummy load. As you get up to the VHF frequencies, it becomes very worrisome as to how you stack the 100 watt, 200 watt, or whatever dissipating resistors together. They start becoming inductive and capacitive. And so, if you've got a long enough length of RG8 cable, the loss of the cable will be an extremely low standing wave ratio, as long as you've done a good job of installing the connectors, an extremely low standing wave ratio distributed lossy network, i.e. dummy load. So take the longest piece of RG8 you can get a hold of, and what little bit of power comes through that, flip over to a piece of RG58, which has got a lot more loss. The only reason you don't use RG58 all the way is it can't tolerate a kilowatt of power, whereas the RG8 can. And then if you want to be a purist, put a dummy load on the far end of that. So the longer your length of distributed attenuator made out of coax cable of the appropriate diameters, the higher will be your quality of standing wave ratio. You could make it a near perfect situation if you use a long enough length of cable. Using techniques like that, you could make an extremely high quality standing wave ratio dummy load to at least 3,000-4,000 megacycles. Whereas if you try to dissipate, let's say 100 or 1,000 watts at 3,000 megacycles, all in one lumped resistor, unless you go through an extremely elaborate construction technique, which you would only see if you took the 500-watt dummy load made by the Weinchel company, and you disassembled it and see what's inside, and you see a very elaborate structure, which coaxially is a half dB attenuator for the first couple of inches, and a 1 dB attenuator for the next couple of inches, and so on. And so it's a slowly tapered mechanical device for maintaining 50 ohms throughout the length of the structure as it slowly dissipates the power. It's got a very low loss coefficient in the beginning and a very high loss coefficient out at the end after a substantial amount of power has already been dissipated. So you could say inside of a high-quality Weinchel dummy load really is the Cadillac version of a long length of a transmission line. Anybody have any further comments? K2LIW.
This is, I got the article, Dick. I had it in my file.
Okay, and Rich is there also. What year, what month of, is it ham radio, Mel, go ahead?
Just June 1979, ham radio. In fact, they tell you here that the way they built it, rebuilt it. See, I remember the resistance about 1,012. Actually, here's how they said to do it. A local surplus be able to easily supply you 2-watt resistance. We bought 1,200 ohm value resistance, and and they put it together. Oh, and 225 in parallel would give 18 resistors. In parallel gave us 25 ohms. We two banks of them in series to make 50 ohms. So that's basically, but they give you the whole thing, how they cut the piece of the copper, that they cut the fin. How they cut the fins and everything here. I don't know. Got to look in the article. But it's everything about how to do it. June 1979 ham radio, Dick, over.
And is that downloadable from QST, from ARRL, if you are a member, to your knowledge?
Yeah, I think you can get it, yeah. I know they have they got the articles, the back articles of QST, QEX, and I think ham radio, if I'm not mistaken, over.
Yeah, I know when you do a bibliography search with ARRL, if you're a member, they will tell you all issues and dates and months of all the ham radio magazines that had the articles. I just wasn't sure that you had direct access as a member to the past article, and maybe they are doing that with Ham Radio Magazine because Ham Radio no longer exists. Skip Tenney, I think, was the publisher, and Wayne Fisk was the main editor, if I got that correctly. Yeah, I think it's Wayne Fisk. Okay. Rich, I think you had a further comment?
That was Jim Fisk, by the way. I was going to comment, what Mel was saying is good, but it's not necessary. MSJ wants Meritron, if you go to the back of their catalog. They're selling high-power amplifier parts, like capacitors, roll inductors, and they have a large non-inductive 50-ohm resistor similar to the one used by Heathkit.
And do you happen to know how many dollars for that device, Rich?
I'm not sure. I'm going to take a guess and say between $10 and $20. I have a catalog, but it's downstairs. It's a little hard to get down.
K2JJ with a comment.
Go ahead, Mr. JJ.
Yeah, good evening, Vic. Yeah, looking in the MSJ catalog here, 200-watt, 50-ohm non-inductive resistor, 1-inch diameter, 6 inches long, $32 and change.
There you go.
And that's for, I think you said 200 watts. Is that true, Doug? And out of curiosity, do they make one above that? And maybe the 200 watts, I wonder if that's when it's immersed in oil. And if it's 200 watts continuous, maybe it can take a kilowatt for 4 minutes, so to speak. What do you think, Doug?
Well, yeah, it's, they say 200 watts continuous. I assume that's not in the oil. Of course, the oil is going to get some more of a dissipation. So, yeah, I would imagine it's good for a kilowatt for some period of short period of time. They don't make a larger one. That's the largest one they have. They make a smaller one, 90 watts continuous. $20.
Very nice. Okay, anybody any further requests on the subject or comments on the subject of tummy loads?
Yeah, I put 2 kilowatts into this antenna, Dick. It gets warm, but I can hold it for a number of minutes, over.
So you're saying that Heath Cantenna will take 2 kilowatts as long as you do for a short period of time. Was there another person making a comment?
Dick, please. I have a inquiry. Not very pressing, but when you get done, it's
real. Yeah, and I've got a request for you guys too, and that is, I own a Fluke Model 77 multimeter, but I don't have a set of leads for it. And you go to the website, and boy, it's difficult to select the test leads. And when you do select the test leads that are mating with it, they cost something like $18, not counting shipment. And anything less than $25, the website will not allow you to make a purchase. And there's nothing else there that I want to buy. So these shielded banana plug test leads that go into a Fluke digital voltmeter. Anybody got a suggestion as to where I can get those? Can be fly like it. And go on with your query, Rich. N2EL, K2LIW.
W2PNJ.
RL and Syosset, N2FL.
Okay, the company in Syosset, I think you said. And Bob, you've got a suggestion too?
Maybe it's the same. Let's see the one in Syosset.
LNL on Robbins Lane in Syosset, maybe?
Okay, you think they have in a plastic package on the wall, you're saying they sell test leads?
Yeah, there is a whole rack of them. You know, I'm not sure exactly what goes to what, but I have picked up some there in the past. Not for that meter, but like Beckman and things like that. So you got a decent chance, maybe.
Very good. And there used to be another industrial electronics store on 454, is it? In other words, Veterans Memorial Highway. in the area of Bohemia. There used to be a store. I wonder if they still exist. Does anybody know?
KC2MDP.
I still exist, but they moved.
Okay, MDP. Someone told me they moved. And MDP, go ahead, Steve. Where have they moved to, if you know?
That, I'm not sure what that store is, but Granger, I know they have a big catalog. I even think they have a website. I know there's several stores. I'm not sure if there's one in your area, but I know Granger will definitely carry them.
Myself, I'm in Bohemia. So they're down Vetch Highway. You have to make a right on Lake Lanier. I think if you go north on Lake Lanier, you send out the Trinity on the right-hand side. They've got a whole bunch of stuff. WM2VUU.
Okay, VUU. When I go to Lakeland Avenue and I'm going eastbound on Veterans Memorial Highway, and if I make a right, I'll be going south. So maybe you were thinking westbound Lakeland Avenue and make a right. And I think you're saying they're on the left-hand side. Ooh, yes, I think I know where that store is. I think I know where that store is. They're very close to the airport. Is that true?
It's true. Yeah, they moved. I couldn't find them for quite a few years. I would have said somebody, it's on Lakeland. Yeah, he's probably right on a, it's a low-profile building, you know, the typical building. And, as far as I know, they had the old place. They had a whole host of test equipment, oscilloscopes, wires, packages, and you got wall-to-wall, looks like Walmart full of components. I passed there once, I didn't have a chance to stop them, but I know they're loaded with components. See, this is transistors, the whole 9 yards. So you might give it a try for the leads that you're talking about. I think they have an awful lot of leads there.
Tonight at 8 o'clock. Next tonight at 8 o'clock.
Okay, I thank you. That's a good suggestion. Also, there's a Granger on Route 111 in the Smithtown Hop Hog area. There's another one near Route 110 in Melville. So, Granger and this one near Vets Highway. Both of them excellent suggestions. I thank you.
WTTNJ.
Okay, yeah, Bob has another suggestion. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, the Granger is on Walt Whitman Road. It's not on Route 110. It's down from the Underwriters Labs on the right side. They got a big selection of Fluke accessories. Also, Schwing Electric on Allen Boulevard has a lot of Fluke.
And there's another Granger. Is it Granger? It's another Granger in Bohemia. Can't think of the name of the street now. It'll come to me. It's one of these airport-sounding streets.
Orville Drive.
Orville, right. That's very close to where I've got to go. Okay, excellent suggestion. Thank you, fellas. That's going to solve my problem. Rich, I know you got another query. Go right ahead.
Okay, Dick, it's OEO. Early this spring, I bought on eBay, they're in good shape, two Motorola GP300s, a VHF 16 channel and a UHF 16 channel. I want to get them programmed up. The problem is getting around with the Walker and McCain place in Flushing, Stewart Electronics that can program them, but there's no handicap parking there. We have a place here in Whitestone called Amtol Communications, but he kind of like, I don't know, he's kind of cool about dealing with hams for whatever reason. Does anybody have a place local to me, so within about 20 minutes, maybe in Great Neck, Little Neck, Douglaston, that area, who I could bring the GP300 UHF, GP300 VHF 2 with a list of UHF, VHF frequencies, get it programmed up, a place where there's good parking in front of the place, handicap parking, and 2EO.
That's a tough one. I'm of the opinion, Rich, that the number of places you can go to get that very high-tech special piece of equipment programmed in Nassau County If someone told me there's only two places in all of Nassau County that can do it, and you know the names of both of them, if they told me that, I would believe it. I wonder if there's a way you can work a deal with Barry in which he helps you get into the place, or he actually walks your radio into the place. Back to you, Rich. Drag your feet in case somebody knows of another place. I'm a little worried there may not be one.
I take a very common two-way Motorola's, VHF, UHF. One is a VHF model, one is a UHF model. They're called GP300s. Any two-way shop can program them up. They use software and a computer. The only thing is I'm trying to find, like I said, Stewart Electronics in Flushing can do it, but I can't park there. Very rough parking, no handicap.
Okay. And I think you're saying there's essentially no way you can, without handicap parking, you're saying you don't stand a chance of being able to get into the building. Is that what you're saying, Rich?
Pretty much, Dick. You know, things are more laid out. If you go out to Nassau County, like I said, Lakeville Road, or, you know, in that area, maybe somebody knows of a place, Little Neck, Douglaston, Great Neck, that area, by the Miracle Mile, maybe a little past. Any Motorola two-way shop that anybody knows of out there can program them up. They're very common radios.
Okay, it doesn't sound like we have anyone on frequency tonight that has an alternate suggestion as to where you can take that radio. That's what I think I'm hearing, Rich.
Okay, well, if anybody has any ideas, maybe is listening, I'd appreciate you emailing me at n2eo@awrl.net. There's 16 channel radios. One is a VHF, one is a UHF. They need the frequencies programmed along with the PO codes, which I will supply for the ham repeaters. Back to you, Dick, N2EO.
Hey, fine, Rich. Good luck with that project. Sounds like these are... By the way, if I go to eBay and buy those radios today, I presume they're 5-watt radios. I presume the VHF version will go almost anywhere from 130 to 160 megs, and the UHF version will probably go anywhere from 400 to 500. I'm just guessing on the numbers. Roughly, what are the dollars that those radios sell for on eBay, Rich?
I was surprised, Dick, not a lot. One I paid $154, another $175. They're used, but they look brand new. I mean, you can't tell they were used. They're unprogrammed. I got new batteries with them. I got bought new antennas for them. They look like brand new. So I do want to get them programmed up. Like I say, they're very common. They're 5-watt radios. The way they're done is with a device called a rip box and a computer and software, which I believe is proprietary. It has to be done by a Motorola authorized center or somebody who's got access. They plug it into a computer, program them right up.
Understand. Okay. There's a slim chance I know somebody that I'm going to ask. I give it a 10% chance, but I'll try. Let me pass it back to Mel. Mel's been reading over his mountain of mail, and maybe he's found another goodie. Maybe even one where the person's asking a question about a Smith chart. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. And I'm just looking at the, I happen to have the catalog here from Granger, and I'm looking at the tech lead section here for Fluke. And they've got them all, Dick, the sheet, everything. Your test lead, let's see, the ones that you're looking for, I think it's the set of test leads here. Grange's price is $17 a tick, so I guess if worst comes to worst, call up Granger, and, you know, they're very good. In fact, they'll ship it right to you, you know, Dick, if you have a commercial account. They'll ship it right to you if they don't have it in stock at the local Granger place. Let's see, anything else here? No, I guess I have to pick through it. I stopped right now, Dick, because I'll see if I can pick out the interesting ones. There's a lot of them that, again, like you were saying, that there was one guy here who wanted me to design some filters for him. He gave me a whole bunch of stuff. He says, you know, Chebyshev filters and everything, and he says, I'd like to discuss with you design of filters, but I would assume for commercial use, so I'm going to just pass over that one. And then there was a couple of questions here about DBs, but we covered this. And if you want, look back on, again, that site is, I believe it's amateur radio, one word. I believe it's www.amateurradio.tv. Am I correct, over?
That's exactly right. Amateur radio, one word, no punctuation, so there's a double R in the middle in there, .tv. And so, as of January of this year, every one of the words that Mel and Dick have said have been recorded, and some of the advertisements have been removed. Let's see. Tangle Lima 75 is the model number of a set of test leads. Tangle Lima 75. That would do the job very nicely. And if you bought them directly from Fluke before you pay tax and shipment, they're $15.70. But their website will not allow you to make a purchase under $25. Even if you're willing to pay them $25, they won't accept it. And there's nothing else there that I need. And by the way, going through their website to try to find the leads for that meter is not easy. They really didn't make it easy. Okay, you just asked me a question. I don't know if I've answered it. I've forgotten already. Thank you, Mel.
KC2KAG, listening.
Okay, yeah, the Tango Lima 75 is correct. That's the one. Yeah, they have it there. It's here for the Fluke model AC-78. Yeah, stock number 1T334 is Granger's number on it, I see. So, as I say, Dick, for Granger, they'll supply it to you, or you know, deliver it to the nearest Granger if you want to do it that way. Over.
Yep, that's a good suggestion. The person who just joined us, if you want to make a comment or a question, go right ahead.
Yes, KC2KAG to N2EO.
Okay, N2EO.
KC2KAG, I just caught the tail end on my scanner of you talking about Stewart Electronics. I know Peter out there. Why don't you give him a call? Or if you want, I could do you a favor. I'm not too far from him. I could stop in and see him tomorrow. And see if he can give you a landline from his location.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I've been in that store. The problem is I developed a disability, and there's no handicap parking. You know how busy it is around there. Roger, and then turn it over to Dick.
Okay, Mr. KAG, I guess he had no further comment. He's familiar with the proprietor or the main man doing the work. But what are the rules these days, Rich, that you know of with reference to handicapped parking? If you're in the five boroughs of New York City, is there a strong requirement or is there a development requirement for that? I'd like to believe sometime in the near future that almost every public facility will eventually have handicap capability. Back to you, Rich.
No, I'm not sure the exact law but I do have handicap plates, not a sticker. I have combination ham radio handicap plates. There's a story involved with that that I won't go into, but around there, that area of Flushing, Parsons Boulevard, the streets are it's a wide street, but there's a lot of traffic there. It's all metered parking. And if I don't get a spot right in front of the store, I'm in trouble. And if I start pulling a walker out of the back seat, holding on to the car, I'm afraid I'm going to get hit.
Yep, I can see that. See, it'd have to be delivered by somebody else that you're able to get out of the right-hand side of the car, which would be safe. Getting out of the left-hand side of the car when you're parked onto the right-hand side of the road. I agree with you. On some of those streets in that area, people do get hit with automobiles, and I see news reports about that. That seems like somebody gets hit every couple of days. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but I don't want to take a chance. The place, like I said, Long Island is a little more spread out. I kind of know the area pretty well around the North Shore, the areas I mentioned, Little Neck, Great Neck, Douglaston, Manhasset, that area. Anybody knows of a place out there that'll do this? It doesn't have to be handicap parking, but just a place where I can get out in front of the store where I'm not going to get hit.
Thank you, Andy. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I guess, Richie, you know, if you want, I think Dick mentioned it to you. Ready to rock and roll. I will head over to your house, pick up the stuff, and if you want, I'll take it to Stewart's and come back with it. You know, you don't have to go if you don't want. I'll bring it over to you.
All right, problem solved. I should have asked you first, Barry. I didn't want to bother you.
Oh, that's okay. I don't mind being bothered.
Next tonight at 8 o'clock.
Are you in the mood to discuss hot air automobiles, Barry?
Well, actually, they're cold air. If you go to Google and type in air-powered cars, you will find a wealth of that information. Something called CityCat that will, they say it's good for 200 kilometers. It's already being manufactured. So it's available already. Zero emission. And it's, I think it's a great idea. I don't know why they don't pursue this further.
Okay, when it comes to the emission of the automobile, I think that's a beautiful solution. Why in the world am I not finding... Oh, I see what's going on here. You said type in air-powered vehicle. Is that what you said, or air-powered car?
I just typed in air-powered car. And I just started to look, and I got this thing, CityCat. There's probably more, but that's the first thing I ran into.
Typing that in right now, air-powered car. I don't know if I spell it right. You're saying there's something here called CityCat. Okay. Air-powered car. I see MIDI air car.
Yeah, that's good. Click on that one. That's the first one I found.
Okay, I've got MIDI. CityCat, there it is. Wow. And if we read down here, I think you're telling me it's going to go 200 kilometers. The good news is the car, and by the way, you told me it would have, when I talked to you a couple days ago, it would have large tanks on top of the vehicle. Looks to me like that CityCat has found a way of hiding the tanks inside the vehicle. And I presume it uses dynamic braking. In other words, the braking really is pumping air back into the tanks while you're doing the braking. Is that true?
I really don't know. This is the first production model I've seen. But I can tell you, I mean, it is open for a wealth of engineering ideas. It's almost endless. I think you and I once discussed, I don't want to, you know, take the whole net up, but I think I should interject here a little bit. We discussed the possibility of using the air to generate electricity to to run each individual wheel. So it's really a stored energy system. It's not as heavy as batteries. It doesn't have the problem of what do you do with the batteries when they get old. I mean, you know, if you do it that way, there's a lot of ways to do this. This guy is eating the air directly, but that leaves him with some other problems. He's carrying around a battery, I guess, for the light and things like that. If you do it the other way, you would have a very small storage system, and I think it's a better idea. But you know what? This is something which is purely in development right now.
And it's got a lot going for it. There's one other catch, though, Barry, and that is, assume you get the mini car, the city cat, delivered to your property, and it arrives uncharged. And you're going to pump air into the tank to charge it. You're storing energy when you put the compressed air into those tanks. Right now, that energy would probably come from Con Ed or Loco or LIPA or New Jersey Power and Light or Connecticut Power and Light, you know what I mean. And they, in turn, are burning coal or petroleum in order to generate that energy. So, although it helps when it comes to the vehicle emission itself, on the assumption that something super is not taking place at the main power station, Con Ed, LIPA, and so on, we're still putting carbon dioxide in the air. Therefore, my thinking on this is that if we had made the commitment, if we, in the near future, make the commitment for solar voltaic, wind, tide, geothermal, Gulf Stream, all of these renewable energy resources, if we make a commitment for one of those, then we've got the non-petroleum raw energy to do this work. So even if City Cat was an extremely popular item right now, it doesn't quite solve the problem. You may have some opinions on that one. And to Mike Bravo, K2RIW.
I got a lot of opinions on that. Yes, I agree with you. You don't get nothing for nothing. I mean, if you're going to go 100 miles or 200 miles or whatever, you got to have the energy's got to come from somewhere. And right now, producing that energy to make compressed air, I don't know if that's as expensive as burning the gasoline by itself. I'm not sure. I got to do the research on that. Simple logic tells me it should be. It should be just as expensive. If you're going to burn gasoline to compress air, you're probably going to lose something in the interim. So, but what I'm thinking here is, if we ever get into this thing, power, I guess you call them power stations, whatever you call it, I can't call them gas stations, air stations, whatever, could be run by wind power, solar power, heaven only knows why. I mean, you know, they're sitting there waiting for you to come in. Wind power would certainly be a way to compress air. There's a lot of ways to compress air without using carbon fuel. So, yeah, I mean, you know, you got to start somewhere. If you have the vehicle, then, of course, you could build the infrastructure in a dozen different ways to put the air pressure in those cars, including plugging it in your driveway at night and burning electricity, you know, if you're not near a power station. But there's an infinite way to do this, and that's what makes it so good.
Yeah, I like it. When you try to store energy in the form of batteries in a car, there's at least two distinct disadvantages. The batteries are expensive. The total amount of energy is not as high as you'd like it to be. Getting beyond 75 to 100 miles of range with a charge of the batteries seems to be very difficult. Ford made a very serious attempt to try to do that, and the car did not become very popular.
Well, you got to consider the fact that batteries are so damn heavy.
So that's the next thing I was going to say. The batteries themselves, in the case of lead-acid batteries, are very heavy, quite toxic. In other words, if you have an automobile accident and those batteries become smashed and the sulfuric acid is spraying around, a lot of unpleasant things happen. I think some of the hybrid cars that are now available, I believe, are using slightly more exotic batteries. I'm not sure if they're... I don't think they're using nickel metal hydride. I don't think they're using nickel cadmium. I think they are using lithium polymer or lithium ion batteries, and they're a little bit more friendly when it comes to toxic materials, still very heavy batteries. Whereas the compressed air with modern-day strong materials, graphite-reinforced materials to make the